175 years, conservative Christians have understood that Mormonism is totally inconsistent with Christianity. Whatever Mormonism is, since its introduction in the early 19th century, Bible-believing Christians have stood in opposition to its teachings. Virtually every denomination has taken a historical stand against Mormonism, viewing it as a non-Christian cult. Today, however, many evangelical leaders seem to have lost their way. I've watched spellbound as some of the most respected Christian leaders in America have stood silent when asked point-blank questions about Mormonism on national television. I've seen the president of a highly regarded evangelical seminary travel to Salt Lake City to tell Mormons in the Mormon Tabernacle that he's ashamed of how evangelical Christians have consistently misrepresented Mormonism. What is happening? Are evangelicals caving in to political correctness in postmodern America, or has Mormonism changed? For me, the answer is clear. Some prominent evangelical leaders have been taken in by a sophisticated Mormon disinformation program. Mormonism teaches the same doctrines today that it taught from its beginning in the early 19th century, doctrines that are wholly inconsistent with Orthodox Christianity. I hope also to demonstrate that some Mormon scholars are publicly declaring that Mormonism has changed when they know it has not. I want to provide an inside look at Mormonism. The next few scenes let you peek behind closed doors and listen to what Mormons are being taught when the outside world is not listening.
It's hard to find references in the Book of Mormon to eternal marriage. I don't think we'll find too much about degrees of glory in there. You only have a passing reference, it seems to me, to premortal existence. How can it contain the fullness of the gospel? This is a very early revelation. This is an insight given to us by Enoch concerning Adam. In fact, let's see if we can get this straight. Joseph Smith's vision of Moses' vision of Enoch's vision of Adam. That sound right? We're really looking through a tunnel, aren't we? So he inherits from his mother, Mary, a mortal woman, the capacity to die. He inherits from his father, an exalted, redeemed man, the capacity to live forever. Those who are sons of God in this sense are the ones who become gods in the world to come. Those who are sons of God in this sense are the ones who become gods in the world to come. Those who are sons of God in this sense are the ones who become gods in the world to come.
We really aren't obligated to answer everyone's questions. I was reading Elder Packer's book, Teach Ye Diligently, where Elder Packer tells of an experience of traveling with President Henry D. Moyle of the First Presidency, and how repeatedly, President Moyle was given these antagonistic and baiting difficult questions by news reporters and interviewers, and how that in every case, President Moyle and the church just came out smelling like a rose. For the Packer was fascinated with this, and as they drove away once, Elder Packer said, "President, that was amazing. What you just did?" He said, How do you do that? They ask you these hard questions. How do you do that? You came out looking great." President Moyle said, "Boyd, whenever a person asks me an antagonistic question, I never answer that question, but rather, I answer the question they should have asked. For example, if a person out of the blue that I don't know from Adam walks up to me and says, 'So you're a Latter-day Saint?' Tell me, you folks believe that man can become like God, huh? See, how do I respond? It may not be the smartest thing in the world to say, yeah, let me quote the Lorenzo Snow couplet for you, and then I'm going to get the teachings of the prophet, and I'm going to read to you the King Follett Discourse. It might be a much wiser approach to say, well, that's an interesting question. It is asked frequently. But, you know, let me begin this way. In the spring of 1820, there was a young man named Joseph Smith, Jr., who was concerned about the subject of religion and wanted to know which church to join. Dot, 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 dot. I just answered the question he should have asked. The issue isn't Adam God. The issue isn't Mountain Meadows Massacre. The issue isn't plural marriage. The issue facing the religious world today is, was Joseph Smith called of God? We never provide meat when milk will do. We never provide meat when milk will do. If a person asks me, for example, why do you Latter-day Saints believe in baptism for the dead? The temptation is to say, oh, because it's in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 29. That's not why we believe in it. We believe in it because it came by revelation to Joseph Smith. It came to him as an independent revelation. Revelations came, and then certain passages in the Bible made some sense. There is power in being loyal to the restoration. Your power will be greatly determined. Your spiritual power. Your power to convince like Nephi and Lehi of old. Your power will be directly related to the extent that you preach from modern revelation. Now that doesn't mean you hate the Bible or you don't use the Bible. We love the Bible. We cherish the Bible. But most of the doctrines that we have to deliver to the world that are distinctive to the Latter-day Saints came not from the Bible, but came rather through modern revelation. A friend of mine did some serious research in Africa. He interviewed 600 persons who had joined the church since the time of the revelation on priesthood. One of the questions he asked all 600 was this: when did you first know that the message the missionaries had to deliver was true? He said 90% of them said, when I heard the words Joseph Smith on my doorstep. You say, well, aren't we here to declare Christ? Yes, but in a different sort of way. Our message is to declare Christ as revealed through modern apostles and prophets. Our job is not to go out and reteach the Sermon on the Mount. Our job is not to go out and reteach the Bread of Life sermon. Our message, our charge is to deliver to the world a message that God has given to us. Now, a colleague of mine served as mission president, and he taught a great lesson. He taught his missionaries to understand this principle. We seek to answer any serious question by finding the most direct route to the sacred grove. We seek to answer any serious question by finding the most direct route to the sacred grove.
In the early 19th century, a young farm boy in western New York founded a new American religion. Mormonism is based on what Joseph Smith Jr. said was a series of visions, beginning with what is now referred to by Mormons as the first vision. Smith said God appeared to him in a grove and told him that all other churches were wrong, all their creeds were abominable in his sight, and all those who professed those creeds were corrupt. It isn't remarkable, given the supposed revelation by God, that Joseph Smith found himself immediately at odds with the Christian world. In his own words, Smith said, "I soon found that telling the story of the vision excited a great deal of prejudice against me." The animosity against Smith and the stories he told of his remarkable vision, along with his unorthodox conduct, would make enemies for him and his followers for the rest of his life. Soon he was telling a story of a visitation by an angel who he said led him to gold plates buried in a hillside near the Smith farm. The antagonism of the locals soon forced Smith to move from New York to Harmony, Pennsylvania, where he continued his work of supposedly translating the plates into what would become known as the Book of Mormon. Soon after the Book of Mormon was published, Sidney Rigdon, a successful Campbellite preacher from Kirtland, Ohio, joined the Mormon Church and brought his whole congregation into the Mormon movement. Smith then moved all his disciples to Kirtland. In Kirtland, Smith built his first temple, although at that time he was not practicing the secret Masonic rituals, which would be introduced later in Nauvoo, Illinois. But in Kirtland, he started what he called the United Order, requiring all members to dedicate their property to the church. He also started a bank, which failed. Eventually, the local townsfolk tarred and feathered him, and he fled Kirtland. Smith fled to Independence, Missouri, where a contingent of Mormons had already established a beachhead. But there, too, the church was in conflict with the so-called Gentiles. The Mormons found themselves in a state of war with the Missourians and were driven out to settle in Illinois. The antagonism between Mormons and the locals festered in Illinois as well. Finally, in 1844, Smith and his brother Hiram were assassinated by an angry mob, and the Mormons were driven out of the state. In time, the Nauvoo Temple itself was burned. After Smith's death, Brigham Young led the Mormons to Utah, but almost immediately Young made public the heretofore clandestine practice of Mormon polygamy. The nation was outraged, and Congress reacted by passing anti-polygamy laws. In some states, Mormons were barred from voting. The largest standing army ever fielded in the United States prior to the Civil War was garrisoned at Fort Floyd in Utah under the leadership of General Sidney Johnston. After the Civil War, Mormonism survived in relative peace in the Happy Valleys of the Rocky Mountain West for 100 years. Within 3 years of Brigham Young's arrival in the Salt Lake Valley in 1847, there were 10,000 Latter-day Saints in Utah Territory. By the turn of the century, there were 250,000 people in Utah, nearly all Mormons. And by 1950, there were more than 1 million. During this first 100 years in Utah, virtually all contact between Mormonism and the rest of the world was through Mormon missionaries working outside of Utah. To the rest of the world, Mormonism was a unique oddity nestled in the tops of the Rocky Mountains. After World War II, thanks to advances in automobile travel, millions of Americans were visiting Utah's natural wonders and its national parks. By the early 1960s, California's population was backing up into Utah along the Wasatch Front. Mormonism met America eyeball to eyeball. The resulting clash forced changes not only in Mormonism's culture, but in its theology. A pivotal event occurred in the summer of 1978. For years, the Mormon Church had refused to ordain blacks to its priesthood. Critics of that racist policy harassed the Mormon Church, even picketing BYU football games, until the president of the Mormon Church received a revelation reversing the practice. This revelation marked the beginning of the end of Mormon isolationism. Although Mormons continued to occupy every political office in Utah, the church was no longer able to act freely without public scrutiny. On the heels of the Godmakers, a new breed of evangelicals challenging Mormonism arose in Utah. The Godmakers did more to awaken the body of Christ to the peculiarities of Mormonism than any other single effort. Tens of thousands of Mormons saw the movie. However, the modern era of evangelical outreach to Mormons actually started in earnest some 20 years earlier in 1965 with the publication of Walter Martin's book, Kingdom of the Cults. Martin also hosted a national radio show focused on the so-called non-Christian cults, Mormonism considered to be chief among them. Martin personally mentored many who became instrumental in Mormon evangelism. Among the Mormon critics who came to the forefront in the 1980s were Ed Decker, founder of Saints Alive, and Gerald and Sandra Tanner, who published the seminal research volume, Mormonism, Shadow or Reality. My own story was unfolding at that same time. By the 1980s, Decker had established an annual conference in Salt Lake City that brought together hundreds of Christian zealots who began publicly criticizing Mormonism. The immediate reaction of the Mormon Church was, as one might expect, vigorous. Brigham Young University scholars mounted a defense of Mormon theology, one of the organizations formed by Mormon intellectuals to combat what they perceived was unfair criticism, was the BYU group FARMS. Another group made up of largely disaffected Mormon intellectuals was the Sunstone Society, where FARMS apologists tend to be active Mormons. The Sunstone folks are often more cultural defenders of Mormonism than theological defenders. Mormon church leadership also reacted to the renewed evangelical incursion. It rolled out a Madison Avenue public relations campaign to make Mormonism appear to be more Christian. The logo of the church was enhanced to emphasize the words Jesus Christ. Television ads began to offer not a free Book of Mormon, but a free Bible. Local Mormon leaders appointed public relations spokesmen whose job it was to approach pastors and befriend them, to try to set up joint worship services, choirs, and Thanksgiving dinners. They asked to be in the local ministerial association. One Mormon book actually told Mormon leaders they might persuade Christian pastors to bring their congregations into the Mormon gospel. It's fair to say the Mormon response to the evangelical attack has been inadequate. The attempt to reconcile the theology of Mormonism to the theology of the Bible is doomed. Nothing better demonstrates the poverty of Mormon biblical theology than the numerous books Mormon scholars have published in a vain attempt to make the point that Mormonism is really not all that different from evangelical Christianity. The Mormon quest to be included in the Christian community has grown over time. In 1997, the book, How Wide the Divide, featured a Mormon scholar and a Christian theologian in dialogue. Reaction to the book in Christian circles was mixed. Many thought that Mormon professor Stephen Robinson, who co-authored the book, was playing fast and loose with Mormonism's true beliefs in order to be perceived in a better light by evangelicals. On the other hand, many evangelicals were elated that such a dialogue could take place at all and suggested that it could only produce the good fruits of harmony, diversity, and mutual respect. If we're going to answer the question, are Mormon leaders misrepresenting Mormonism? We need to establish what Mormon theology actually is, and that isn't as easy as one might expect. Walter Martin's evaluation of Mormonism, a nightmare of garbled doctrines masquerading as Christianity, is certainly apt. In Mormonism, doctrines are made to be changed. For example, once the church swore it would never abandon the practice of polygamy, but in 1890 it stopped solemnizing polygamous marriages, although it refused to abandon its polygamous theology. How could it, if God gave it to Joseph Smith as the new and everlasting covenant and essential to Mormon salvation? Fundamentalist Mormons to this day, those who remain true to Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, continue the practice, nearly 50,000 of them in the western United States. Again, the church for generations taught that blacks would never hold the Mormon priesthood until all other humans on the planet had had the opportunity to do so, but that changed in 1978. All of the standard scriptures of Mormonism have been changed repeatedly. The Book of Mormon itself has been changed in more than 4,000 places. Joseph Smith even changed the King James Bible, producing what he called the inspired version of the Bible. Interestingly, very few Utah Mormons read that version. All of these changes can be very confusing to those who want clear answers to the question, what do Mormons really believe? It's nearly impossible for investigators to get straight answers to reasonable questions. This can be very frustrating to outside observers. And all this confusion arises from the fact that Mormon theology is not primarily founded in the Bible. Rather, it's a mishmash of so-called revelations. Can an honest investigator of Mormonism ever come up with a meaningful doctrinal outline of its theology? In order to lay out an honest Mormon theology, one must investigate and uncover the primary messages of Mormonism as preached and taught for the past 175 years by its leaders and scholars. To describe Mormon theology, we will look at three sources: the founding fathers of Mormonism, the 20th century scholars and leaders, and the 21st century scholars and leaders. It is from those sermons and scholarly writings that Mormon theology arises, a theology which, since its inception, has outraged the Orthodox Christian community. To comprehend Mormon theology, it's essential to understand how that theology developed. Mormon theology did not develop from studying the Bible. It's not exegetical nor expositional. Neither does Mormon theology arise from the Book of Mormon. Rather, Mormonism is a theology of declaration. The declarations of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and other Mormon prophets. When Joseph Smith organized the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in 1830, he had a small band of followers who revered him as the man God had chosen to restore primitive Christianity to the earth. His revelations became accepted as scripture and published as the Book of Commandments, later as the Doctrine and Covenants. It seems obvious that Joseph Smith invented his theology as he went along. He had a smattering of Bible knowledge, he understood some Christian concepts, but really, he was a denizen of the backwoods of the so-called burned-over district of New England, a psychic highway that gave a Shakerism, the spiritualism of the Fox Sisters, and the sexual communism of the Oneida Society. Smith was immersed in the folk wisdom that Mormon historian D. Michael Quinn called the magic world view. Smith received revelations whenever controversy arose, or whenever one of his followers brought up a puzzling Bible reference. Smith prophesied on all manner of doctrinal issues: the nature of God, baptism for the dead, what heaven is like in the way of salvation, and when Christ would come again. He even received, he said, a revelation on polygamy, a practice that survives to this day. In that revelation, God supposedly told Smith that his wife Emma had to accept polygamy or be damned. Once Smith's prophetic mantle was secure, he began to announce doctrine in his sermons, as well as in his special revelations. After his death, apostles and prophets of Mormonism continued to articulate doctrine as they saw fit, especially during the first generation of prophets who followed Smith. The president of the church continues to this day as prophet, seer, and revelator, although modern prophetic announcements are few and far between. Joseph Smith's initial pronouncements about the nature of God are his most powerful and his most offensive contributions to theology. His first vision is the encounter he claimed he had in 1820 in a grove outside his family's farm in Palmyra, New York, when he was but 14 years of age. That vision, which has been revised often since he first reported it, announced two radical and heretical doctrines. He said that he'd seen two personages in his vision. He said they appeared standing above him in the air. One of them reportedly pointed to the other and said, "This is my beloved son." The significance of the first vision cannot be overstated. It has remarkable implications. As Smith himself repeatedly stated, and as Mormon scholars have pointed out ever since, the vision claims to be the first official contact God had with man in nearly 2,000 years. And as demonstrated in this presentation, the implications of what Smith claims to have heard from God will erase the essential differences between man and God. The first vision makes the claim that God the Father and God the Son are two separate and distinct individuals, and that each of them has a body of flesh and bone. If Smith made no other contribution to theology, that statement alone would clearly and forever separate Mormonism from Christianity. But it's worse than that. The second revelation to come out of the first vision was God's supposed response when Smith said he asked God the question, "Which of all the sects is right, that I might know which to join?" He said he was told he must join none of them, for they were all wrong, and all the creeds of Christendom were abominable, and all who professed those creeds were corrupt. It is impossible to overstate the significance of the first vision. Every key Mormon doctrine has its source in 73 words from the Pearl of Great Price, which is still Mormon scripture. The keystone of all Mormon theology is that scripture which declares that there is no essential nor qualitative difference between God and man. Understand this, and you will forever understand the beguiling attraction of Mormonism, that the only difference between God and man is a matter of development and degree. Or, as Mormon President Lorenzo Snow would eventually proclaim, as man is, God once was. As God is, man may become. In Mormon theology, the distinction between man and God is not an essential one, but merely a quantitative one. All Mormon scholars and priesthood leaders, past and present, are in agreement on this central revelation of Mormonism. Snow was ordained a Mormon apostle in 1849 and served the church until he died as its president in 1901. Like Mormon leaders who preceded him and followed him, he clung to this foolish oxymoron that God is man. In our day, Professor James E. Ford, formerly of BYU, summed up Mormon theology in Newsweek magazine by saying, "Mormon doctrine means that ultimately we are not dependent upon God for our existence, and since we can make ourselves as godly as the Father, we don't feel any jealousy toward Him." Orson Pratt, who has been called the greatest mind of Mormonism, said, "God, angels, and men are all part of the same species, one race, one great family." And Brigham Young himself said, "Man is King of Kings and Lord of Lords in embryo." John Widsoe, noted author and educator, and a 20th century Mormon apostle for more than 30 years, said, "God and man are of the same race, differing only in their degrees of advancement." Joseph Smith was murdered by an angry mob in the Carthage, Illinois jail just 14 years after he founded his church. Less than 90 days before Smith met his death, he preached a now famous sermon which has become known as the King Follett Discourse. In this sermon, he recorded in the greatest detail his theology about God and man. The King Follett Discourse was presented to a congregation of about 20,000 Latter-day Saints at a general conference of the church. Willard Richards, Wilford Woodruff, Thomas Bullock, and William Clayton took notes of the address, which are considered by scholars as accurate, near verbatim. A complete version, reconstructed from those transcripts, was published in the church newspaper, The Times and Seasons, August 15, 1844. In the sermon, Smith said,
"There are but a very few beings in the world who understand rightly the character of God. The great majority of mankind do not comprehend anything, either that which is past or that which is to come, as it respects their relationship to God. They do not know, neither do they understand the nature of that relationship, and consequently, they know but little above the brute beasts, or more than to eat, drink, and sleep. God Himself was once as we are now, and is an exalted man, and sits enthroned in yonder heavens. He was once a man like us. Yea, that God Himself, the Father of us all, dwelt on the earth the same as Jesus Christ Himself did. You've got to learn how to be gods yourself, and how to be kings and priests to God, the same as all gods have done before you. In the beginning, the head of the gods called a council of the gods, and they came together and concocted a plan to create the world and to people it. The soul, the mind of man, the immortal spirit, where did it come from? All the learned men and doctors of divinity say that God created it in the beginning, but it is not so. The very idea lessens man in my estimation. I do not believe the doctrine. I know better. The mind or intelligence which man possesses is co-equal with God Himself."
After Joseph Smith was murdered in Nauvoo, Illinois in 1844, the church moved to Utah under the leadership of Brigham Young. settling in the Salt Lake Valley in 1847. Temporarily isolated from nosy and irritated neighbors, the church began in earnest to build the city of Zion in the tops of the mountains. As the church established its roots in the West, scholars began to try to assemble a theology based on the revelations of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and others. That process has gone on ever since. In 1885, Brigham Young Academy was established on an acre tract of land in Provo. In 1903, the name was changed to Brigham Young University. In 1968, the official historian of the Mormon Church, Leonard J. Arrington, surveyed 50 modern scholars, asking them to list the five top Mormon intellectuals from Mormon Church history. Of the 38 scholars who responded, 35 listed Brigham H. Roberts, most of them listing him as number one. B.H. Roberts was a Mormon general authority and elected to Congress, but never seated because he was a polygamist. He was a Mormon scholar of the highest order, with a Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of Southern California. B.H. Roberts must be considered the greatest apologist for Mormonism who has ever lived. That opinion was confirmed by another Mormon scholar, former U.S. Commissioner of Education under President John F. Kennedy, Sterling M. McMurrin. McMurrin said of Roberts that, in the domain of knowledge and reason, B.H. Roberts was the preeminent leader of Mormons. McMurrin says that Roberts was a true believer who said, if Joseph Smith's vision of the Father and the Son was not, in fact, an objective, actual, genuine experience, and if the Book of Mormon was not brought forth as Joseph Smith insisted by the hand of God, in very fact an account of God's involvement with ancient Americans descended from people of ancient Judah, the church and its priesthood and Mormonism as a religion are abject frauds. McMurrin knew that Roberts understood that Mormonism was a radical departure from Christian history. Quote, more than any other thinker of his time, Roberts sensed the radical heresy in Mormon theology, its complete departure from the traditional Christian doctrines of God and man. Roberts was a prolific writer, authoring several works of history, including the massive Comprehensive History of the Church. He also edited and wrote the introduction of the Mormon Church's official 7-volume History of the Church. This history was taken from the journals of Joseph Smith himself. Roberts wrote a 100-page introduction to the 7 volumes for the 1904 edition. One of the primary purposes of the introduction was to lay a theological foundation describing why it was imperative for God to restore Christianity to the earth. This concept, the restoration of the gospel, began with the initial encounter of Joseph Smith and the two beings in the Palmyra Grove. But think of the implications of the Mormon idea of restoration. Only something which has been lost is in need of restoration. This suggests that Christ's act of establishing the Christian church had failed. According to Mormon theology, Christ's disciples literally dropped the ball so that the church and the priesthood of God were lost, lost, lost from the earth, requiring God to, quote, set his hand a second time, as the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants declare. The restoration was the work of the prophet Joseph Smith in an era called the Dispensation of the Fullness of Times. If the restoration is true, Jesus was wrong when he said in the New Testament book of Matthew, chapter 16, verse 18, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. For the restoration to be necessary, the gates of hell must have prevailed against the church, which is what God supposedly told Joseph Smith in the Palmyra Grove. So the theological twin in Mormon theology to the restoration of the gospel is the concept of the utter failure of Christianity in what Mormonism calls the universal apostasy. This thought, the idea of the universal apostasy, was foremost in Elder Roberts' mind and surely uppermost in the minds of the First Presidency when Roberts penned the 100-page introduction to the official history. In his introduction, we read,
"It is a most startling announcement with which the prophet Joseph Smith begins his message to the world. Concerning the question he asked God, which of the sects is right and which shall I join? He says, I was answered that I must join none of them, for they were all wrong, and the personage who addressed me said that all of their creeds were an abomination in his sight, that those professors were all corrupt, that they draw near to me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They teach for doctrines the commandments of men, having a form of godliness, but they deny the power thereof. This is a tremendous arraignment of all of Christendom. It charges a condition of universal apostasy from God. The boldness of the young prophet is astounding. Nothing less than a complete apostasy from the Christian religion would warrant the establishment of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There was no possible excuse for the introduction of a new Christian sect."
Then, for 100 pages, Roberts attempts to prove his point.
"It now becomes my melancholy task to trace through the early Christian centuries the decline of the Christian religion. By this I mean a really unchristian religion was gradually substituted for the beautiful religion of Jesus Christ, that a universal apostasy from the Christian doctrine and the Christian church took place. The gospel was taken from the earth, divine authority lost, the church of Christ destroyed. There was but one way in which all these could be restored, by a reopening of the heavens and dispensing again a knowledge of the gospel, by once more conferring divine authority upon men. In a word, it would require the incoming of the dispensation of the fullness of times to restore all these things."
Mormon theologian Sterling McMurrin said the most impressive theological piece to come from an accepted Mormon writer was B.H. Roberts' book, The Mormon Doctrine of Deity. As the title implies, in this work, Roberts attempts to set forth clearly the basic foundations of Mormon theology about the nature of God. This book grew out of a response Roberts wrote in two installments in the Mormon magazine, The Improvement Era, in 1901. The article, a response to criticism the church had been receiving from Christian ministers in Salt Lake City, addressed, quote, "The Mormon Doctrine of Deity." After the Roberts article was published, Father Cyril Vanderdonkt, a Catholic priest from Pocatello, Idaho, wrote a 24-page response to it. Uncharacteristically, the Improvement Era published the priest's response, but then allowed Roberts to respond to the response. He did so in a 100-page rebuttal to Vanderdonkt. Together, those three Improvement Era articles make up the body of the Mormon Doctrine of Deity. In his book, Roberts defends in punishing detail what he described as the three foundational teachings of Mormonism, teachings which incensed the Christian clergy of his day. The book is in print today, published by Signature Books in Salt Lake City, and advertised as a defense of the following three principles. Quote, "First, we believe that God is a being with a body and form like man's, that he possesses a body, parts, and passions, that in a word, God is an exalted, perfected man. Second, we believe in a plurality of gods. Third, we believe that somewhere and sometime in the ages to come, through development, through enlargement, through purification, until perfection is attained, man at last may become like God, a God." 100 years has passed since Roberts defended these three points. Some Mormon scholars would have evangelical Christians believe the Mormon Church has abandoned or modified those cardinal doctrines. There's not a shred of evidence that that is true. On the contrary, virtually every Mormon leader and scholar has endorsed those doctrines up to the present day. Just as B.H. Roberts was the preeminent Mormon scholar of the first half of the 20th century, that honor must be accorded to Sterling M. McMurrin, in the second half of the 20th century. In some ways, Sterling M. McMurrin was an enigma. McMurrin was born and raised a Mormon, educated as a Mormon, married in the Salt Lake Temple, a member of the Mormon Church until his death. He was related to and friends with numerous Mormon general authorities. However, he called himself a loyal heretic. McMurrin rose to philosophical and educational heights. Starting as a Mormon Institute instructor in Arizona, he would become a professor of philosophy at the University of Utah and eventually the United States Commissioner of Education under President John F. Kennedy. He lectured on Mormon theology at BYU, Utah State University, Ohio State University. He turned down the presidency of the University of Utah. His book, Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion, has been called the most lucid and penetrating work on the theology of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This by no less an intellectual than L. Jackson Newell, president of Deep Springs College and former dean of liberal education at the University of Utah. Apparently, some Mormon leaders wanted to excommunicate McMurrin during the 1950s for his outspokenness. But Mormon President David O. McKay said he would be the first witness for McMurrin's defense in any church court. The opening sentence of Theological Foundations says the most interesting thing about Mormonism is that compared to Orthodox Christianity, it incorporates a liberal doctrine of man and a radically unorthodox concept of God. On the same page, he restates these ideas by saying, "The distinctive character of Mormon theology is its finitistic concept of God and its denial of the traditional doctrines of original sin and salvation by grace." Theological Foundations addresses three major concepts: the Mormon concept of reality, the Mormon concept of God, the Mormon concept of man. Regarding the concept of reality, McMurrin says that Mormonism is based squarely in materialism. He says that in Mormonism, there is no immaterial or purely spiritual substance, and that spiritual beings are no less material than other physical objects. In Mormonism, he says, matter is eternal and uncreated. McMurrin says materialism is defended consistently and emphatically by Mormon theologians. And in Mormonism, he says, the only reality is matter in motion. Part two of Theological Foundations is entitled The Concept of God. Here, McMurrin states, Mormonism denies the traditional doctrine of creation ex nihilo, creation of the material universe out of nothing. Creation in Mormonism is not creation at all, he says, but a fashioning of the world from pre-existent, eternal, and indestructible elements. He says the finite concept of God reveals Mormonism's radical nature of heresy. This Mormon scholar is telling us clearly that whatever Mormonism is, it's not biblical. It's heretical. It's unorthodox. McMurrin knew what all those terms meant. He chose them carefully. McMurrin further states that Mormonism rejects the classical concept of God as eternal. He says Mormon doctrine is tritheistic, a doctrine he calls heretical, and that the Mormon term Godhead merely refers to three divine individuals who have an external relationship involving total agreement. McMurrin quotes the prophet Joseph Smith's teaching that man, like God, is a self-existent being and that man's intelligence is co-equal with God. The battle between Mormonism and evangelical Christianity has seesawed for the past half century. Prior to World War II, Mormon missionaries were scattered throughout the world, encountering prospective members in their homes. Evangelical response was isolated to occasional outraged denunciations of Mormon proselytizing. That all changed in the late 1970s and 1980s. Many factors combined to motivate evangelicals to go to Utah to confront Mormonism at its headwaters. By the 1980s, a vigorous debate was occurring in Utah, led by people like John L. Smith, Gerald and Sandra Tanner, and Ed Decker. At one capstone conference in Salt Lake City, evangelicals used a hand truck to take thousands of petitions to the Mormon Church office building, petitions asking the church to stop calling itself a Christian church. By the 1990s, Mormon scholars arose in response to these overt evangelical forays into Utah. However, instead of the traditional arguments focused on Mormonism as the restoration of a lost Christianity, the new argument was, why are you evangelicals picking on us? We're Christians too. Thus began a concerted effort by Mormons to minimize the differences between Mormonism and evangelicals. One of the early attempts at such minimizing was a book written in 1991 by Stephen E. Robinson, chairman of the Department of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University. Robinson opened his book, Are Mormons Christians?, with a reference to the above-mentioned capstone petition, which he said was signed by 20,543 people from 49 states and 31 foreign countries. Robinson was perplexed at how anyone could doubt that Mormons were Christians. After all, wasn't the name Jesus Christ part of the official name of the Mormon Church? Robinson defended the idea that Mormonism is Christian by defining the term Christian in a way that evangelicals can never accept. His definition would include virtually everyone who says they are a Christian, regardless of how biblical their doctrines are. Dr. Gordon Lewis, professor of systematic theology and Christian philosophy at Denver Seminary, says Robinson's definition of Christianity is too broad to be useful. He said Robinson's approach to legitimizing Mormonism can only succeed if a Christian does not need to believe in one personal transcendent God, one incarnate Christ, the completed atonement, and one gospel of grace through faith alone. Robinson was not alone in his response to evangelicals and doctrinal pursuit of Mormonism. Countless other Latter-day Saints joined Robinson in an attempt to prove that Mormonism must be considered Christian. Eventually, Professor Robinson co-authored a book with an evangelical scholar to discuss the differences between Mormons and evangelical Christians. The book, How Wide the Divide, co-authored with Craig L. Blomberg of Denver Seminary, was published by an evangelical publishing house in 1997. As its title suggests, it was an attempt to measure just how different Mormonism is from evangelical Christianity. How Wide the Divide sparked an ongoing debate. Scholars from both sides of the divide arose to critique the book. One was Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and author of numerous books and articles on apologetics. White says Robinson did not paint an accurate picture of genuine Mormon theology. In his desire to minimize the differences between Mormons and evangelicals, Robinson refused to affirm, White says, what has been taught by the Mormon general authorities of the Latter-day Saint Church for 150 years. The book was also critiqued by two more prominent evangelical scholars, Paul Owen and Carl Mosier. Owen and Mosier are serious evangelical students of Mormonism. The Owen and Mosier critique of How Wide the Divide had 227 footnotes. Their conclusions say that Mormons and evangelicals agree on many things. However, quote, we maintain that LDS beliefs remain unacceptably outside the boundaries of Christian orthodoxy. They also state that Mormonism teaches these things. 1. A theologically unacceptable form of finite theism. 2. An implicit denial of monotheism. 3, an inappropriate description of the relationship of the Father and the Son. And 4, a heretical concept of the nature of man. So evangelical scholars who read How Wide the Divide answered the question by saying, very, very wide. Of course, Mormon scholars then responded to Mosier and Owen. David L. Paulson and R. Dennis Potter, two Mormon scholars, agreed that the divide was not nearly as narrow as Robinson thinks. David L. Paulson has a law degree from the University of Chicago and a Ph.D. from the University of Michigan. He's a professor of philosophy at BYU. R. Dennis Potter is an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and Humanities at Utah Valley State College. Without actually saying that Robinson was guilty of minimizing differences, they offered their own view of many of the points brought up in How Wide the Divide. Their view confirms that the divide is very wide indeed. For example, Paulson and Potter reaffirmed the traditional Mormon theology, which states, God is finite, although Paulson says he no longer uses the term finite because it is often misunderstood. They also reaffirm the Mormon position that God has a body. These Mormon scholars confess that creation was not ex nihilo. And they say the Orthodox Christian definition of God's omnipotence is incorrect. They say God is a material, not an immaterial being. They say there is no difference between the godhood of God, the Father, and the godhood men may attain. And finally, they say that the Trinitarian idea of oneness in the Godhead is wrong. The Father and the Son, for example, do not share a oneness of being, but simply a oneness of mind, purpose, and intent. So the evaluation of How Wide the Divide by both Mormon and evangelical scholars confirms that the divide is extremely wide. The most current scholarly examination of the gulf between Mormonism and Orthodoxy is the New Mormon Challenge, published in 2002. It is edited by the aforementioned Owen, Mosier, and Francis J. Beckwith, a philosopher from Baylor University. This book has much to offer evangelical students. It's more than 500 pages, contains articles by a dozen highly qualified Christian scholars. Hundreds of citations demonstrate that Mormon leaders, past and present, defend a gospel vastly different than the gospel of Christ. Returning again to the same themes we've repeatedly discussed here, the authors demonstrate what the Christian churches agreed upon for 175 years, that Mormonism is not Christianity because it teaches radically different doctrines. I'm grateful for the exacting scholarship of the authors. Here they reaffirm in painstaking detail that Mormon theology continues to reject ex nihilo creation. They also say the Mormon view of the nature of God differs at the most fundamental level with Christianity. They say Mormonism teaches monarchotheism, the theory that there is more than one God, but one God is preeminent over the others. These dozen evangelical scholars state that Mormonism's worldview is materialistic, and materialism, they say, is absurd. They say Mormonism does not fit any historical Christian option, and its claim to be a different, restored form of Christianity fails. They also say it is not intolerant for Christians to declare that Mormonism is not Christian. In the New Mormon Challenge, these scholars say the Book of Mormon is most likely a product, not of ancient times, but of Joseph Smith's own time, and is influenced strongly by ideas extracted from the King James Bible, and they conclude it's not plausible that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon from any ancient gold plates. Finally, they say the Book of Mormon is a complex, ambitious, pseudo-translation of King James Version ideas, and that it relies heavily on extant writings known to Joseph Smith. Of course, those who work among Mormons are very familiar with the ideas discussed by these scholars. Their new book does, however, give us fresh ideas and new looks at old Mormon errors. I, for one, am grateful for the serious work these men have produced. However, I must confess there are two aspects of their work that leaves me deeply troubled. First, it seems that these brothers are convinced that most of what has gone before in evangelical confrontation of Mormonism has been mean-spirited and inaccurate. And it is true that some Christians have been less than charitable in their approach to Mormons. Eternally important issues are at stake, and rhetoric does wax warm. In the last half century, virtually all of the true evangelism to Mormonism has occurred when Christians, convinced that Mormonism is wrong, deceptive, and dangerous, strike that pose when encountering it. Some of the encounters are indeed polemical. The message often is the familiar repent, or in the vernacular of the 1960s Jesus movement, turn or burn. But the body of Christ should not easily give up the fiery preaching which has characterized it for 2,000 years. The second mistake these scholars seem to make is somehow to believe that the dialogue they have in academia translates directly to the marketplace. They actually seem to suggest that those academic debates should serve as a model for Mormon evangelical interaction. This is simply ludicrous. I sincerely wish they would be content to feed their scholarship to the pastors and evangelists without attempting to define the way in which their scholarship is used. The interaction between Mormonism and Christianity does not take place in ivy-clad classrooms, but in the muddy and bloody streets where pastors and evangelists confront a demonically inspired religious system which bends the minds and desiccates the souls of its victims. Do these scholars think the structured academic exchanges they have with their Mormon peers is anything like day-to-day religious interaction? Have they sat up through the wee hours holding the hands of Latter-day Saints who are weeping their way out of an abusive system? Certainly they must be aware of the appalling social statistics wafting from Mormonism, signaling the depth of the despair of people locked in bondage to blasphemous spiritual ideas. I'm appalled at the disdain I hear coming from some evangelical academics. Disdain directed at those who've gone before in pioneering outreaches behind the Zion Curtain. For example, Richard J. Mao, president of Fuller Theological Seminary, wrote the introduction to the New Mormon Challenge. He said, until very recently, the exchanges between evangelicals and Latter-day Saints had been of a very poor quality. He said, I'm ashamed of our record in relating to the Mormon community. He said, until very recently, the work of evangelicals among Mormons has been that of propagating distorted accounts of what Mormons believe. He said, evangelicals have borne false witness against our LDS neighbors, and in doing so have sinned against them and against God. And he stood up in the Salt Lake Tabernacle and said such things to a predominantly Mormon audience. And the Mormons loved it. After Mao appeared at the Tabernacle, along with noted evangelist Robbie Zacharias, Kerry Moore wrote in the Deseret Morning News, "It will be Mao, not Zacharias, that Utahns will remember." Thankfully, many evangelicals arose to challenge Mao's confusion. Mike Gray, pastor of the largest Southern Baptist church in Utah, was quoted in the Baptist Press News saying, "Some of my people were there and they were turned off by the whole event because of him. Mao was wrong, and it will hurt. Mao is insensitive, inaccurate, and ignorant." An official press release from the evangelical cult watch organization, Evangelical Ministries to New Religions, said, "Dr. Mao's comments were irresponsible, shameful, and hypocritical. He bore false witness against many fruitful ministries." Of course, Dr. Mao did not document the sins he charges against his Christian brothers. However wise he may be, he is ignorant of the real-world battle for souls within Mormondom. For a seminary president to somehow get the idea in his head that the Gentiles in Utah for the past 100 years have abused the Mormons is ignorance and arrogance of the highest order. It is tantamount to saying that the blacks of the antebellum South abused the white plantationists and owe them an apology. He ought to ask the Gentiles in Mormondom who really has been abused. A number of years ago, the Denver Post sent a writer and photographer to Utah who, when they returned to Colorado, published a 100-page supplement to the newspaper entitled Utah, the Church State. It documented real life in Utah. Will Jarrett, the editor for the Post, wrote on the opening page, "We sent our writers to pierce what is called the Zion Curtain, where the line between worship and government has become so blurred that some civil rights have evaporated." I believe G.K. Chesterton said it best. He said, "There is a notion abroad that to win a man you must agree with him. Actually, the opposite is true. Each generation has had to be converted by the man who contradicted it the most. The man who is going in a wrong direction will never be set right by the affable religionist who falls into step beside him and goes the same way. Someone must place himself across the path and insist that the straying man turn around and go in the right direction."